A new Lannister era, thought Tyrion. Oh, brother, I fear I've made other plans for that day.
Welcome to the White Wolf Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast. Founded in 2010 as Two Chimps and a Chump, we thought it best to rename and rebrand ourselves freshly just in time for the game to keep the same in the second edition. Tune in each week for your dose of strategy, discussion, jokes, and good old geek culture. A huge thank you goes out to GRRM for his amazing novels, FFG for this fantastic game, Card Game DB for getting us a start, and you, our loyal listeners, for sticking through thick and thin. Check us out on our website, Facebook, or Twitter, or email us at contact@whitewolfpodcast.com and rate us on iTunes. This CC licensed music is Town Function by Spinners.
Quality of this episode just went up like 1,000%.
If that's such a
thing as possible. Several notches. We cranked it up to 11.
Yeah,
I get that reference.
As do I.
It's a quality film, listeners. If you don't know what I'm referencing, go look it up. Then go watch it.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, welcome back to, what is this, episode 295 of The White Book. The clock just keeps on ticking. This week, it's myself, Will, and of course, I would argue most stalwart co-host over the last year.
Roy Rogers, and stalwart is a sweet keyword, so I appreciate that.
You know, I always liked it. I feel like with the right kind of support card design, it could have been really cool in first edition.
Well, I feel like they never really tried to push the design of it, right? There was that one added. And it was interesting because you draw two cards in Game of Thrones, so that means, you know, you're seeing that card plus one other. I don't know. I think it's definitely something that if Nate and Eric and Damon had decided that they wanted to really push that keyword, it could have been much cooler, but they just, I guess it wasn't design space they were interested in exploring. So
hashtag bring back stalwart.
Yes. Well, the game needs more keywords, so.
Yeah. While we're at it, can we bring back infamy? Because that's another one I feel had boatloads of unused design space.
But I feel like they tried to explore infamy, at least. There were some, like, interesting infamy cards, you know what I mean? Like, even if they weren't really playable, you could definitely see that they were trying to play around with it. But I feel like stalwart, they just forgot that it existed as a keyword after like the third cycle of the LCG.
Yeah. All right. I think before we just got angry.
Before we lose all the non-1.0 players, I'm Alex Black, by the way.
Oh, hey, we have a guest host.
It's me. I'm back.
Yeah.
I'm back in black, as they say.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
I'll go ahead and give some huge thank yous to Alex up front here for stepping in at a moment's notice to round out the panel this week. So thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Always happy to be here.
Well, tell you what, guys, now that we've already driven away all of the new players, shall we turn our eyes to the topic for this week?
Bringing new players back.
Yes. So last week, we hit the kind of high end of the competitive scale pretty hard, talking nationals and Euros and some of the state of the meta at the moment. This week, We're gonna crank the dial back the other direction
and talk new players. I'm pretty sure Roy has been begging to tackle this kind of topic again for at least a couple months, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that perennially when we're discussing topics, I'm like, well, why don't we do a new player episode? Or why don't we do update our famous episode 222, which is probably one of my favorite episodes that we've ever done, which required, I think, 3 recording attempts to complete, but we finally did. Yeah.
That's commitment.
And it paid off in the end. I think I would still, listeners listening now, I would still direct you to listen to episode 222 and this episode as you kind of try to get started in things.
Yeah, absolutely, because we go over a lot of sort of the fundamentals from just a core set. I mean, one of the things that's nice if you're a new player with that episode, you know, we don't really talk about it in the context of cards you may not have. If you only own core sets, that episode is perfect for you because we talk about it was made in the core set meta, so we only talk about cards that are available there. I think maybe the first pack was out by then. I can't quite remember.
Sounds right.
The timeline was so weird, right? Because it launched at Gen Con, then sort of trickled out, and then the first pack was so delayed, but some people had it because they went to Worlds. It was all a very confusing launch, typical FFG launch. But the point would be more, it's probably of all of our early episodes, even I think certainly much more than the card reviews that we did. Like I was on the Martell one, I think has aged like a fine wine.
Yes. Yeah. I think the relevance point of that stays a lot higher, especially like you said, you know, if new players are just starting out with the core set anyway, 222 kind of stays a worthwhile snapshot of that era.
And a memorable number as well.
Exactly.
Easy to type into the White Book website. Whitebookpodcast.com.
Yeah. Sure enough. Go stream that sucker. Okay. Well, enough about past attempts at this episode. So how about we turn our attention toward what we would like to talk about to new players this time around. We've got a little bit of an outline. We've got, I guess, kind of, you know, 3 or 4 kind of main points to hit on here with some sub-points and thoughts among them. So let's say, assuming, you know, you've got your cards, whatever sort of collection you may have, later in the episode we'll come around to maybe what that collection should or could be. But to start with, you're sitting down and you need to be able to play. And to do so, you're going to have to start with deck building. So to me, that seems like the best first topic for this episode.
Yeah, could I start with a question, actually? I know recently on the AGOT Facebook group, it's been sort of a contentious topic, the issue of deck lists and their availability online. And I think, especially for new players, I think having access to top-level deck lists from a competitive standpoint, like if you're a competitive card player, you want to get into competitive Thrones, having access to those deck lists from the get-go is really an invaluable resource. But would you agree with that? Or do you think that, you know, you'd rather a player come from like a more organic place where they're sort of building their own decks and strengthening their deck building skills as well as their play skills in the early parts of their Thrones career?
I feel like there is a bit of a middle ground, here in my mind, at least. In that I do think that it is beneficial for people to spend some time right at the beginning to construct a deck and go through some tweaks and such. Not only to learn the mechanics of building it, but also to build it to cards that look interesting to them and that they like. Because let's face it, when you're brand new to the game, if you're sitting down with people that have already been playing for a year or two or whatever, you're just probably not winning those games. So like any little step to help that be more palatable, I think is good. And in my mind, at least, playing with the cards and characters that you like rather than starting right off the get-go with a deck that was just, so to speak, handed to you from the internet probably ups your stick-to-itiveness. but I do think that once you get through that first, you know, month or two and get into understanding the mechanical flow and that construction process, then I do think it is a huge boost to have those online resources and use them and grab one of those decks. Once you have the basis to understand that, then I think having those lists gives you this huge leg up to kind of fast forward through the next, you know, 6 to 9 months worth of kind of skill building. So there you go.
Yeah. How about you, Roy? Where do you fall on this?
Well, I think focusing just purely on someone who wants to immediately get up to competitive speed, having a series of competitive decks that you can build and play with is really important. And for someone who doesn't have a meta, like I was lucky enough to have, that was able to sort of mentor me and give me decks and over time let me play decks that I brewed up against their decks and all that kind of stuff, having really proven successful decks available online is great. And that's sort of where net decking it for new players is really great. And luckily in second edition and mostly in first edition as well, there are plenty of those decks. You can find a good default Heart Fealty, a good default Lanny Reigns. You can find a good default, well, you can find the Nationals winning deck list for Stark yep. Watch, the best Night's Watch deck right now that is out there. Right there, boom. Those three decks right there, if you build them and you play them against either your homebrew deck as a new player or you play them yourself to better your skills, you've got it. And I think, and this is what I said in the Facebook thread, I think a lot of this is ginned up, this controversy over deck sharing, because I feel like a lot of deck sharing is done in this meta, in our community, even if literally every winning deck list is not shared, or if particularly in the summer hyper-competitive season that sort of stretches from regionals to Gen Con World Stalic, kind of that like 8 months in the middle of the year, that's where you get the big metas being much more secretive. You know, you didn't see DC posting draft lists of the Stark Watch deck until they showed up with it, right? But, and they, you know, weren't on podcasts. Even you see podcast hosts not necessarily talking about their best decks. That's certainly true on the White Book, and it's 100% true on Beyond the Wall and Banter Behind the Throne, Southern Betterment, the Brotherhood guys. No one goes on and says, I'm going to be playing this on Saturday, you know, that kind of thing. So
bring it on. Yeah.
Bring it on. I think there was a controversy that was sort of ginned up in over that sort of like long weekend of Thrones about decklist sharing when there's plenty out there. Like when I was a new player, I went on Agot Cards, and I found plenty of decks that I tested against, downloaded, played, and did all kinds of things. And that's even more so for second edition. ThrowsDB has a huge number of proven deck lists and a huge number of unproven deck lists on its service. So I feel like if you want that as a resource and that's how you want to build your skill as a high level player, it's there, it's done. There's really not a controversy over it.
Sure. Yeah. I do think you have a point. It's valuable to start your Thrones experience off by sort of tinkering, you know, on your own. But I don't think that you have to do it for that long before, you know, playing with a well-oiled machine, you know, really shows, like, sort of highlights the sort of the craft of deck building, and you can sort of compare it to your own brews and see maybe what you're doing wrong and try and adjust from there. So, well, I just thought it was a sort of an interesting hot button topic that we could mention at the beginning of this. So,
yeah, no, I think that is very worthwhile to go ahead and kind of tackle, especially with it being a point of discussion recently in the Facebook group. Well, on to deck building basics themselves. I mean, when folks are looking at either building their own deck, or I'd say let's go ahead and kind of broaden this to, you know, kind of taking a look at and analyzing some of these published deck lists, you know, what are they most likely to be seen as kind of baseline considerations for stuff? You know, things like character and location counts, kind of some of the sure. plot selection, things like that.
I think a decent place to start is actually limited locations. It seems like there's pretty much like a gold standard for the amount of limited locations that decks are running, as long as they have access to them. I think Night's Watch being sort of the exception to the rule, most decks play somewhere between 8 and 10 limited locations in their deck. Can we kind of agree on that as like a baseline?
9's the median number, I would
right.
say.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. Like I've seen decks with 8. I've seen decks with 10. I don't think there's anything really wrong about either of those numbers, but 9 is definitely the most common.
So if you're a new player and you're sort of building a deck, like a skeleton of a deck, the first thing I would do is put, it's a mono faction deck, so let's just say, I would put 3 Rose Roads, 3 of whatever your faction, 0 cost reducer, and then make a decision about whether or not the 2 cost location for your faction or a Great Hall, but there's going to be sort of, you know, put the in faction, the new 2 cost reducer in, or Rose Roads, right? For a long time, it was, you know, in faction reducer, 0 cost Rose Road, and then King's Roads, right? Now with the 2 cost, limiteds and Great Halls, there's a little bit more flexibility, but shooting for sort of starting your deck with 9 limited locations is a really good point, because you already know that you'll be able to afford just about everything that you're going to be playing, and you'll have a steady ability to draw economy throughout the game.
Yeah. And then, you know, from there, it really varies as far as the locations go. There are plenty of decks that only play the limited locations. They don't play any other locations. So it kind of depends on what faction you're looking at playing. But I would say that most, 99% of decks have are within a certain range as far as like the character count is concerned. Most I see are somewhere between 30 and 37, 38.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say about the median is 33.
Yeah, I think my old rule of thumb used to be 30 in first ed, but in second ed, I think it's probably moved to 35 characters for me.
I agree. Yeah. I've played plenty of 30, 32 character decks where there are just too many times where you run out of threats. And I agree. I think that you have to be careful if you don't have a lot of ways to smooth out your draws, whether it be just like in the plot line or whatnot. Playing like a higher character count is just a safer bet for a newer player.
Yeah, I agree. So much of the game, you know, kind of revolves around the challenges, and without delving too much into that section of our discussion, you know, that's a big part that new players like, and it's knowledge that is mostly on the board, which is a little easier to grok, as the saying goes. So I think, yeah, leaning character heavy is definitely a good direction for new players, as opposed to going, you know, attachment heavy or event heavy or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely in second edition, going character heavy is seldom a problem unless you're going like 3 Theons, 3 Ashas, 3 Balons, 3, you know, you're just literally only throwing 3 copies of literally every character that you can click in on.
Right. It's important to remember that a diversity of threats is needed when deck building, especially with the existence of Valor. Putting 3 of all of your unique characters in the deck is sometimes a recipe for disaster if the game becomes like very attrition based or longer, where you need to be drawing relevant threats in the off the top of your deck, and you're, you know, half of your characters are dead now due to certain effects. So I think, you know, playing the 3 of your favorite characters, a handful of them, is fine. I don't know if you guys have like a limit to how many three of unique characters you would play in a deck at the moment, but I think three or four is like the top end. I don't think I'm playing more than that.
I don't know if I have a hard limit, but I do have, I guess, kind of a caveat to throw out here for new players. I mean, you know, if you're sitting here and all you've got are three core sets or whatever, I would say there's probably more lenience toward going ahead and playing 3x of those power characters in that deck. But as your collection grows and you have more of a breadth to choose from, I think it definitely behooves you to embrace that, as Alex was saying.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a more fundamental question that we sort of skipped over, which was, what is your deck sort of win condition really puts? And that, I think, is really the first question a new player should really think about, is sort of like, how, like, because when working with new players and myself and thinking about when I build decks, I sometimes forget this, and it's the most fundamental thing. It's like, how is your deck? Obviously, you want to get to 15, and you can just sit there and win dominance. Well, and that's one way we can get there. But you know, what is the win condition that your deck's trying to push? And new players often just put their favorite cards, as Will was saying. You know, they'll be like, "Ooh, Jon Snow is a start card. Rob is a start card. Eddard is a start card. Arya is a start card. Bran's a start card." There's like all these awesome characters that they love, and they'll just slam them all together. Or you know, "Ooh, it's like this is an expensive cat. I'm going to put her in with, you know, this and all this kind of, you know, and with, ooh, a four-cost Arya. Four-cost must be better than three-cost."
Right.
Right. What you really want to think about is, like, what does your deck want to do? Like, do you want to put pressure on people through big claim effects or things like Put to the Sword that are going to put them to zero, as in the words of Steve Simonian, so that they can't do anything, you just win because...
Yeah, like in other card games, there are like the three pillars of sort of like deck focus, or like what sort of attribute you would give to a deck, what combo, control, aggro. And Thrones is a little different, right? Because combo is not really a thing per se. It's more like control, aggro, rush, maybe, is like the other pillar, sort of.
That's what I've kind of said. Fills the combo role in Thrones, right? That it becomes rush.
And this is not to forget that there are variants in between, right? Like there are decks that encompass like multiple angles, but these are sort of the pillars of deck design and like the focus of a deck. So like Will said, if you're a rush deck, then your focus is likely to be getting to 15 power as fast as possible. If you're a control deck, you're very likely to want to include cards that have synergy with, you know, being able to control what your opponent's doing. And then aggro is you want to just kill everything they have. I guess that's kind of the simplest way to explain those things. So, I do think it's important to sort of pick one of those in the very early deck building. You know, in the very early stages of deck building, and then try to find as much synergy with that idea as possible. I think you're more likely to find success in the early going if you try and build with that in mind.
And you have more fun.
And I would say,
absolutely.
Yes. And especially if you're coming at it from a limited card pool, I think you're going to be looking at these cards and, you know, I would say don't shoehorn, or don't feel like you should shoehorn, or don't try to shoehorn houses in directions they're not kind of meant to go. I feel like the card pool, if you have the whole thing at this point, you have multiple options for several houses. But you know, when you've got that early limited card pool, you're just not making a Greyjoy control deck, for instance, right? Like, You obviously have some rush options when you look through those cards. You probably, depending on your exact pool, have some pretty solid aggro options, but just not the control. And other houses are in similar boats. You know, Martell probably just can't do aggro. So
I think they can do aggro. I just don't think they can do rush. Well, I mean,
maybe not rush. Yeah,
I mean, I don't know. There is a Martell crossing deck. I mean, we're getting into semantics here, but Yeah, it's I think it's just important to determine, you know, what sort of like what you want to be doing, whether it's aggro rush or control, and then try to figure out what faction that attracts you that you can fit it into that mold, so to speak.
Yeah.
I think that one of the wonderful things about the meta now, like you said, if you do have all access to everything, is most factions for about the first year of the game's life had sort of this like singular focus competitively. And now we're sort of starting to see these alternative sort of themes or sub themes in the factions, and we're starting to see, you know, multiple different deck types come out of just a single faction, which is really nice. So I'm excited for the way that's going. I think I have a sort of a basic tenet as far as events and attachments go. I think there's always there's always the exemption to the rule, right? But I usually don't. I try not to go over 15 combined attachments or events. A lot of times, because certain attachments are what I call negative attachments, or they go on your opponent's characters, and those and events cannot be set up. So you don't want to have too many cards in your deck that can't be set up, because it will just lead to inefficient starts. And that's something I think that is important when building decks as a new player. Wouldn't you think?
Yeah, I absolutely think so. I also think when it comes to attachments, you need to. This is a huge, another big new player thing. Is you need to say to yourself, if you have an empty hand and you top deck two copies of this card, if you're running two copies, are you going to be happy?
Right.
And this is particularly because a lot of positive attachments fall into the case of no, I wouldn't be happy.
Right, because you need a character for them in order for them to do anything, correct. Firstly.
Negative attachments are different, like, you know, an imprisoned or a craven. Well, that means I'm not getting a military challenge, and Tywin, it will just be an expensive Iron Throne this turn. But a throwing axe and Corsair's Dirk, like, uh-oh, I have to win a challenge for these things to work.
Right.
My opponent has to defend for throwing axe to work. And like you often see when I play new players in tournaments, or new players come to meetups, where they're running a bunch of these really cool attachments that seem awesome, but then they win games with them, but it's difficult to tell yourself, are you winning those games because of those attachments, or are you winning them because your deck's fundamental strategy is solid? You just happen to, you know, these cards are win more cards. Because
right.
A lot of positive attachments are win more cards, and they're the kind of cards that you want to stay away from, particularly as a new player. Because I've also seen new players get frustrated that they're playing these seemingly cool attachments, but when they're behind, their deck just isn't giving them the cards that they need to get back into the
game.
Can
we define win more for new players? Because a new player might hear that term and say, well, yeah, I want to win more, so that seems good, right?
Right.
Yeah, that's a good point.
A win more card is a card that it is only good when you're winning. What was the quadrant episode that we did, Will?
I should have marked down the number. Probably in the mid-230s.
Yeah, the mid-230s. This is Luke and Will and I did this episode. And it's a card that's only good when you're ahead. And those cards are often trap cards. Now, some of them are good closers that sort of can shut your opponent out, but a lot of them are big trap cards that are cards that seem awesome and seem flashy, but they really just, when you're behind, they're so utterly useless that you could lose the game because you top decked them.
Right.
And those are the cards you want to keep as far away from your competitive level deck as you can.
Yeah. So basically, to this summation, there's no point in winning more when you're already winning. So a win more card is just, it's kind of, it's not necessary.
Let's provide some concrete examples of cards that could be confused, just to be quick.
Sure.
So, So Throwing Axe is a win more card. You've won the challenge. Your opponent chose to defend with a good character. You trigger Throwing Axe. You kill that character. That's a win more card, because you already are winning by so much that your opponent feels comfortable to put that character, or is stupid enough to put that good character in the challenge that you can kill.
Sure.
Superior Claim, which seems like a win more card because you won by five. That's huge, but it grant it gets you actually to your win condition, right? That's why it's not a win more card. It's a card that furthers a win condition of a rush deck, which is to get to 15 as fast as possible. While Throwing Axe is not that. Throwing Axe doesn't even get an aggro deck. It require where it wants to be because it requires your opponent to misplay for it to be good.
Yeah, that's a good example. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
So, do you guys have like a kind of a rule of thumb as far as cards you can't set up in your deck when you're deck building that you just don't want to cross that threshold?
Tentatively, I'm looking at maybe 12-ish at the moment, like that are hard, cannot set up. But it's another aspect that has shifted for me some as I've gotten used to the slightly different flow of second edition from first. Now that virtually all economy is limited, now you do have cards that are a pseudo cannot set up. So, you know, it used to be just a hard decision of, well, I can't set up events. And formerly couldn't set up attachments. Here in second edition, it's just attachments I want on my opponent's cards.
Right.
But now to complicate that, I have much more of a consideration of where my limited count is. And while, yes, I can play one limited card on setup, the higher my kind of resource count in the deck with these limited cards, you know, the greater odds I draw three of them in an opening hand, and well, now two of them are non-setup cards. So I feel like that number has dropped for me as time has kind of gone on. I think 12 is my rough cap, but I think often I'm looking at 10 or 9 these days.
Sure. It might be a better place to start for a newer player with, like, the lower that number is. I think, like, as you get into more advanced deck building, like, that number can drift higher and you could be fine. But at least for a baseline for, like, new deck building, I think that, like, a number close to 10 or maybe 8 perfectly acceptable. So, and just before we get too far away from characters, I wanted to talk about like a cost curve. I think that it's important to remember that though we do have control over the vast majority of the economy we'll have from turn to turn in the form of the plot card, it's important not to put too many cards that cost, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 in your deck. And I usually find myself building decks with at least about somewhere between 15 and 18 characters that cost 3 or less, just so that, you know, you have characters in play to soak up for military claim, and just so you can set up sort of a few more cards and you get a couple cards deep in your deck. I don't know if you guys have any opinions about that.
Yeah, appropriate cost curve is probably the key way to build a functioning Game of Thrones deck. And I think it's weirdly one of the harder skills to master, because as you said, since unlike games like Magic or Hearthstone, a Game of Thrones game, you control your economy mostly, and you can particularly build up, and we'll get to this when we talk about plots, you could build a plot deck that's designed to let you play more expensive characters, but there still comes a point where, because of the variance of card games, you just aren't going to be able to necessarily play those plots in an efficient way. You could just end up with a hand that's, you know, if you run 5, 7 cost characters, you could run a hand that's all 5 of those characters plus 2 dupes. Right, and that's just not gonna, even with the best economy plot, unless you go like trading into like a summer harvest into someone's what trading?
Sure, yeah, that's pretty good.
It's the only way you can, like, try to think of like how you can get ridiculous amounts of gold in the first turn. Like you're not gonna be able to play those cards. So finding that right match between disposable characters and impactful characters is something that you want to balance. And I think, yeah, 15 is right there, is good. And I think you want to focus more as well on 2 cost characters, because setups are really important. Even, you know, 2 and 1 cost characters are really great, because you could do 6-2-0 or 7-1-0. The Tywin Chud Rose Road setup, right? That is like the dream Lannister setup, or the Robert version of that, or, you know, Blackfish or Rob with the Tuukka's character. These are all like the ability to play on the first turn your impactful six cost character, or begin the game rather, with your impactful six or seven cost character plus a cheap character is really the ideal second edition setup for many decks these days. Mm-hmm. And the ability to get that. It's easy for newer players to see the Robs, but the Roberts, the Tywins, but not to see the Tumblestones,
the Red Cloaks.
The Red Cloaks, the, you know, I'm trying
the to. The Bastard's Daughters.
Yeah, those kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Because they're not as flashy, they're not usually named characters, things like that.
Yeah. And I think. To go along one sec, Will, to go along with the nine limited locations that were kind of like auto include, just like put them in your deck. I think you should start pretty much every deck, 99% of decks. Maybe it's slightly less than that, but especially for beginners, just put the 3-1 cost reducers from your faction you're playing into the deck. Just start with those 12 cards and then work your way up.
I agree.
And yeah, like Roy said, a significant number of 2-drops is always good, just because the way the math works, 2s play really nicely, and 3s don't as much unless you're playing a lot of 5s. And yeah, so definitely sort of build on those ends, the lower and the higher ends. And I like to sort of – I don't usually play a lot of cards in the middle, like the 3, 4, 5 range, just a very select – number of high impact cards in that cost range. So especially with the addition of Great Hall recently. So, and we can talk about that a little bit if we want, but oh boy, has Great Hall made the 6-drop so much better than the 5-drop.
Well, that may be getting beyond the scope of the new player.
Yes, I think that's reasonable.
I think it is worth expanding briefly on what Roy is talking about maximizing those setups, because there is kind of an underlying assumption to the point Roy is making that may not necessarily be obvious to every new player here, in that when you really boil these games down, these games meaning card games of this similar sort of constructed nature, they are really all just a game of resources, of economics of one form or another. And really the two resources in Game of Thrones, at least those that are going to impact setup, are cards and gold. And because you have this setup pseudo phase to start the game, attempting to leverage that and come out of the gates with the kind of maximized confluence of, you know, spending that full 8 gold that you have available to you and getting as many cards in play to start, which of course equates to, once you refill your hand, cards drawn and so on, just puts you ahead of that underlying resource game. You know, if you can really try to maximize that, I think you come off better. Whatever that combination may be of cost points in your deck, trying to make sure that you have the greatest number you can that come out to that even 8 gold and are, you know, 3, 4, maybe even 5 cards is really going to help you just from then on through the game.
It's concerned, or I guess we haven't talked about plots. We should talk about plots.
Yeah, I think, I mean, because plots are the most fundamental difference that Game of Thrones has, I think, from any other card game. And I think it's probably what makes Game of Thrones games so dynamic and interesting is the plot deck. And it's probably, I think, building a plot deck, a successful plot deck, is probably one of the hardest skills to master. Particularly for new players, and it's, I think, something, even though now that I'm on year 3 of playing this game, both in first and second edition combined, I still am far from perfect at coming up with an ideal plot deck on decks I'm working on. So I think it's a really important thing to look at. And for new players, I think they need to make they want, the first thing you want to look at is, what are you going to open with? What is the first plot that you consistently want to play? And you usually want, I think, one or two options that will make, you know, that you can say, all right, on the first turn, if I have a good setup, I can play this. If I have a to a bad setup, I can play this. So a plot for someone who just has the core set or has a limited thing, like Calm over Westeros is a really good plot to look at as an opener because it has solid gold 5. It has positive traits, Summer, which cannot be hit by another plot, Naval Superiority, which can wreck your economy by causing you to count 0 gold off your plot card. And it also can protect you from military challenges if you set up very few characters. It can protect your hand if you don't have any intrigue icons. It's also a good plot later in the game to protect your power total, you know, so if you don't want to open with it. And of course, the other classic opener is for newer players is Noble Cause. Noble Cause is sort of the platonic ideal of an econ plot in first edition. It is just kind of like, it provides you with 5 gold plus a 2 gold reduction if you're playing a lord or lady, which just encourages you to play those impactful lord or ladies that second edition has so many of them. And so I think those two plots, if you're a new player, are sort of the two plots you might want to gravitate towards as sort of starting when you're building your plot deck. Just put those in first, right, and then later maybe cut them if you find other things that synergize with your deck. But that's sort of where you should start because that gives you an option. If you have, just drawing from Lannister, like a hand that's like you set up maybe 3 characters and you know it's like, okay, I've got Tywin in my hand or I've got Tyrion or Jaime, boom, Noble Cause. Ooh, I only set up 2 characters, they're not that great. Or like I set up Cersei and like a 3-cost character. Ugh, I don't know. All right, I'll open Calm and say military challenge so that there's no claim for the military challenge. And that's going to give me some breathing room to set up on the first turn.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what you should be thinking about when you're looking at the first steps with your plot deck.
Yeah, I even find now when I'm deck building, I'll have a sweet brew going and I'll be getting to the plot deck and I'll build the whole thing and then I'll play with it and realize that I don't have a single opener. You know, it's still a trap that I fall into, you know, when deck building is, you know, sometimes you think of all the utility for these certain plots, but if you don't have a good opening plot, that can really affect the success of your game.
So
I think that's really a good place to start. And I usually as a baseline try and include at least 2 like really efficient or good econ plots in the plot line. Not all of them are great openers necessarily. I do find sometimes trading can be a risky open. I don't know if we're limiting our discussion to just core set plots or are we
not just core set. I think it's worth mentioning some of the others.
Yeah. I just wanted to start with core set plots as kind of
I think yeah no it's a great place to start, definitely. I just, you know, at least 2 high econ, and when I say high econ, I mean virtual 7. You know, I think Noble, you know, while it gives you 5 gold, it's a virtual 7, right? Because if you're playing it, usually you have the Lord or Lady, like you said.
I was going to say, I would maybe modify that a little bit just because we were talking about cost curves.
Sure.
I would say that those high econ plots should be ones where you can play whatever the top of your curve is. A lot of times that is really the 7 point. Cost beat stick, but maybe you've built a lower curve and you top out at 5 or whatever it might be.
Yeah, maybe you're playing a Martell deck and you don't play any 6 cost characters other than maybe Varys. So that's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, I think if you have an expanded card pool, like I think the safest opener to include is Time of Plenty.
It's because, such a common opener these days, and it's so good.
It's so good because it gives you 6 gold, 1 initiative. If someone opens Noble or something like that, you're fine. A high reserve, but also it smooths out some of the variance because you are going to see 3 cards instead of 2 on the first turn. So if you had an okay setup but drew into kind of crap, it lets you see an additional card.
Yeah.
And you don't really care what your opponent does. Like, I think it's, again, a trap. And then when I first saw the card, I think I was on the review of it. I was skeptical, but I didn't say my serious card. But like, you have to remember, you should always trust that the cards in your deck are going to further your game plan more than whatever your opponent's going to do. So you seeing that third card is more important than the fact that your opponent is going to see another card as well. And so the ability to smooth that out, or if, you know, or you had a poor setup, but you drew back into good cards, that six gold plus an additional card that, you know, maybe you've got a Tywin, or like a Tyrion that you can play, and you draw into a one cost reducer now, so you can do Tyrion plus one drop, or things like that, right? It gives you the flexibility both in gold, it's protected again from naval superiority, and reserve, and card advantage that you really, it's really the ideal opener if you have the full card pool available to you.
Yeah, the reserves, it seems inconsequential, but there are a lot of first turns where if you only commit one, maybe two cards to the board, that you're actually going to be flowing over the average reserve of six. And I find that seven is like the perfect number on turn one. There are almost never any scenarios where I have more cards than that in hand. And so, you know, a lot of times if you have excess cards, like eight or nine, and your reserve is six, your opponent's not going to prioritize making an intrigue challenge because they know you're going to have to discard some cards at the end of the turn anyway. So that reserve, though it's a small impact, I do think it's an important one. And Time of Plenty is a really strong opener right now. So, so after the econ plots, do we go for the low end or the sort of the middle range?
I think one of my next considerations is, I don't know. I think I have two other kind of plot categories that I always try to hit on. I frequently try to hit on, I should say. I think both of these are not as guaranteed as the opener that we have been talking about. So I'll mention them real quick and then kind of say why there. I think the closer and the reset, as the case may be. And frequently decks that want one do not want the other. But sometimes there is overlap there. The closer, in my mind, being something that those rush or aggro decks really want to kind of seal the deal, that either straight up wins the game for them, say with the capability to claim extra power with something like Clash of Kings, and of course nice bonus there in having high initiative to dictate you know, whether where you're going in the turn, or maybe aggro deck with something like Winds of Winter to really wipe the opponent's board with additional claim that they weren't able to fend off. Whereas, you know, other decks are maybe looking – other decks – read control decks, though I think you know, some in-between flavors of other things want to reset to bring things back to parity with a Wildfire Assault or something. So whether I need one or the other of those is usually my next consideration after having at least one option as an opener.
Do you think it's imperative that at a beginner step that all decks, you know, all beginner decks include that reset, so to speak, like that Wildfire Assault or that Valor?
I think that's a wise starting point.
I think if you're a brand new player, you're better off choosing Wildfire as your reset, because I think
also true.
Wildfire has a lower skill cap. It has more room for error.
Yeah.
Than Valor. Valor is easily the most complicated plot in the game. Its interaction. There are people who have been playing since the CCG, and they still haven't mastered exactly the best ways to Valor, when to Valor, how Valor interacts with what your opponent's doing, what you want to do. And I think second edition's dupe, as you know, the dupe land that it is, makes that even worse. So I think Valor is a card that you should come to after you've played some games with Wildfire and seen what Wildfire does and what it doesn't do, and then try slotting Valor in. It would be my advice to a new player.
I think
Wildfire takes way less pre-planning to make it effective. It can much more readily be, and I think this is great for new players, it can very much be, oh crap, this past turn got way out of hand. Next turn, I can just go into Valor and go from there. Whereas Valor doesn't really operate that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And particularly if you're a new player who's drawn to some of those like more impactful characters, like you're playing a Bera deck that you're running Mel, Stannis, and Robert, and you love those characters from the books, probably not from the show because the show didn't really treat those characters particularly well. But you know, those are three characters that you can save with Wildfire. Those are the three characters. You know, like Wildfire says, what to save? Save those big, flashy characters. Save your Rob, your Jon, and your Eddard, right? Or your Rob, Arya, Eddard, or whatever. It's easier to sort of, like, just intuit what characters are to be saved with Wildfire and what characters your opponent is going to save with Wildfire, more so than Valor, because Valor requires just dupes and saves and all this kind of stuff that's not always clear what's going to happen.
Okay. So two econ plots, you know, depending on where your cost curve is, two plots where you can play any card in your deck, a reset, or, you know, would you say most decks need a closer as well as the reset, or are they kind of the same slot?
Well, I want to sort of direct this towards something a little different, because I think what you really need to think about is what you're going to do in the middle of the game, where you either need to refill your resources or answer something your opponent's going to do. And not necessarily in a reset, but in a sort of tempo way, in a way of sort of like your opponent has gained an advantage in the game. How are you going to answer that? So there's sort of three plots that I want to point to that are sort of like middle of the game plots that can help you regain the tempo or help you answer what your opponent's doing or refill what you have. On the refill end, counting coppers, which lets you draw three cards.
For sure.
It doesn't give you very much gold, but it lets you draw three cards and has 10 reserve. So you'll see five cards minimum that turn. And even if you don't play a single card that turn, you've got options for the going into a turn where you have more economy, more whatever. And that's definitely something I think Counting Coppers should be in every beginner's plot deck. Bare none. Because it just gives you so many options. It's a great middle of the game play. If you don't know in the middle of the game what to do, just play Counting Coppers. You'll find something to do that turn. Next would be Confiscation, which is a great answer to your opponent. On multiple levels. The most straightforward one would be get that Milk off your Tywin, that Kraven off your Eddard, but also can hit positive attachment that your opponent had. It could be a Seal of the Hand, a Lightbringer, a Bodyguard. Bodyguard is a really amazing attachment to hit. Get that Ghost, I don't know, Ice, whatever, that your opponent has. And then the third would be Retaliation. That might not seem immediately, but the fact that Retaliation is a great mid-game plot because it means you've set up, you've played a bunch of cards, you don't have that many cards in your hand, you need to start putting the pressure on your opponent. You need this game to say, look, I'm going to pressure you, I'm going to further my game plan, I'm going to do what I want to do. So it's a great second, third, fourth turn plot where I'm set up, boom, I'm going to hit you as hard as I possibly can. I'm going to go second, I'm going to see what you're going to do, and I'm going to slam you in the face now. So I think when you're building your deck, those three plots Counting Coppers guaranteed should probably be in there. Confiscation should probably be in there just simply because attachments are such a pain. And in many cases, as a new player, Retaliation is just not a bad auto-include in your plot deck.
So I love Retaliation, but do we need to be hesitant at all about it with its 4 reserve? Or are we and sort of suggesting its use as a mid game plot? I think it's a great opener in certain situations, but I don't necessarily know if I'd recommend that to a beginner. You know,
I surely wouldn't. Yeah, that 4 reserve
would not either. Complicates it. Not in second edition. In first edition, yes. In second edition, no. I think it's a great mid game. I think it's a great middle of the game plot for a new player, because by the time you get to like plot 3, plot 4, you're floating around somewhere between like 2 to 5 cards in your hand, right?
Right. No, I totally agree with you. I just wanted to make sure we were okay with recommending, you know, a four reserve plot to a beginner. But I think it's a great plot because I love going second, especially you get to see what your opponent's going to be presenting to you, and you can adjust accordingly. And then, yeah, you really get to put the – like you said, by that time, usually the hand sizes are down, so your entry claim is extra strong. And especially if you're playing an aggressive deck at all, a two-claim plot needs to be in your deck, and I think Retaliation is the perfect two-claim plot to play right now. So is that all the plot slots, or are we missing any?
Yeah. We've nearly dictated an entire specific plot deck for sure. New players, but I think it's a baseline that's good for a lot of houses and archetypes.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the plots we've suggested here, like you could build Calm. What do we say? So Retaliation, Counting Coppers, Confiscation, Wildfire, Calm.
I'm missing Time of Plenty.
Time of Plenty, and then a
Wildfire?
Flex.
Did you say Wildfire?
Yeah, I said Wildfire. Like okay. A flex plot, like maybe a Noble Cause or Calling the Banners or a second Con and Copper, second Retaliation.
And it's one of those things where I think for that last plot, you really need to examine what your deck wants. If you're playing Power Rush, you probably want Clash of Kings. If you're playing you know, a really high curve Lannister deck, you probably just want a third high econ plot. Or, you know, the Nationals winning deck, you know, where it was basically all econ and a couple utility plots. There's nothing wrong with that. Like, the more econ you have, the more often you're going to be able to play what you have in your hand, which is there's absolutely no reason why you couldn't do that. I think a good utility econ plot is Calling the Banners. It's one where, you know, you're not going to play it on turn one. It's better mid game, but if your opponent goes extremely wide, then it rewards you and you can maybe find board parity on that turn. So there are a lot of good options for that last plot. And sometimes, you know, maybe if you have a pet plot, it's a good slot. It's a good place for that as well. I'm a big fan of the long plan personally. I usually try to shoot into all of my Martell decks, even though it's a good opener. It's also pretty strong in the mid game before like a Counting Coppers turn, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Awesome. So do we have anything else to cover for deck construction specifically, or
I think we can just sort of move on to sort of a couple other things we want to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, we already went so far as to nearly dictate an entire starting plot deck for people. I think that segues nicely to kind of recommending good starting decks. Well, archetypes of decks. We're not going to sit here and spell out an entire deck list as well for folks. Draw deck, that is. But, you know, to at least give you an idea of the sort of good starting places.
Sure. Now, do we want to talk about just like good wholesome decks, or are we going to talk specifically about like the strongest decks in competitive Thrones per se?
I think what we should probably focus on is strong competitive decks for a person with a limited card pool. Would you say that one?
And I think skill set is also worth a limited skill set is worth considering. My kind of pet suggestion for starting archetype is due largely on that and maybe less on sheer competitiveness, though.
Okay.
You know, it's not just going to roll over. But yeah, I think those are kind of three considerations that compete against each other a little bit.
Do you mind starting us off, Will, with an example?
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, I think my pet suggestion, especially from a limited card pool, is actually just going to be like Greyjoy, Rush, or Aggro, kind of a combination, like especially out of that just core set meta. They have several threats that they drop to the board that, I mean, really do need answered, or they're just going to keep doing their thing. It's very much kind of a fire and forget. It's not a deep deck. It's not a top tier cutting edge deck, but it keeps, you know, kind of presenting threats and forcing the opponent to come up with answers
And I think that is a good starting point for people that are newer from the skill perspective.
Sure, yeah. And even just adding a couple chapter packs maybe to get like Lords of the Crossing and a couple other things, like that deck is pretty good with just a few of the products that you'd need. So I guess my suggestion would be, especially like thinking in terms of like limited card pool or more explicitly a core set, Baratheon Control. So probably like Baratheon Fealty. I think that deck is pretty strong out of the core. You know, you have Robert, you have Mel, you have Core Stannis, the R'hllor package, Red Keep is really solid, and you get the Chamber and Iron Throne, which, as I mean, is still really strong even today. I think that's, you know, if you fancy yourself a control player, you like to control what your opponent's doing, you're going to kneel their characters, you're going to win dominance, you're going to win power challenges, and you're looking to win the long game, I think Baratheon Fealty, or Barra Control, I guess we could call it, is a really good place to start. And I don't think the skill cap is particularly high. You point your kneel effect at their largest character every turn until you win the game sometimes. And that's sometimes that's just enough, you know?
It's basically the flip side of the Greyjoy Rush deck I suggested. It presents the threats, the Greyjoy does. The deck you suggest answers those threats.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think actually if you were literally about to go to a regional and you were a brand new player, I would suggest you, and you only had the core set, you could take a Barra Fealty built with just a core set and get a positive record.
Absolutely.
At the tournament. Like it's literally like when people say
pending skill.
Pending skill, obviously. But if you have
still a
game.
Side note, my bit of advice to new players is don't enter those tournaments expecting you're going to win it.
Right. I don't expect winning, but I think you could end up with a, you know, 3-2 record in a 5-round tournament if you have some card game experience with the core set Barra Fealty. Mm-hmm. Cuz I think it has synergies. Yeah. And as you said, like it's a deck that actually is a really good deck to start learning the game with, because it's a deck that rewards practice.
Yeah.
And it will raise your skill over time. Like the obvious plays, oh, that person has Tywin. I have Scene in Flames and Mel in play. I will play Scene in Flames in the challenge phase and kneel Tywin. Like, yes. But like the nuances of the deck, when to play certain things, when to hold back, when to use your Scene in Flames when you don't have Mel, but you want to empty your opponent's hand of some threats or see what your opponent's hand is. Anyway, long term, I definitely agree, Alex. Like, I think that that's a great deck. It's definitely the best starter deck. Again, as a point of entry, the best purchase. If you just have a core set, the best decision for you to play on a competitive level is Barra Fealty. The other one I would suggest is Stark Fealty. Particularly if you get the three core sets plus the Stark box, it is kind of a deck that builds itself. You take at least one of all those named characters you remember from the TV show and the books, put them in a deck, put some economy cards, done. Put three cats, make sure there's three cats.
Would you recommend going sort of more of an aggro route with that, with like ice and winter is coming?
I think, like, you know, that's like ice and winter coming, it's not necessarily aggro. Like, the thing about playing the sort of big name Stark deck, particularly with a limited card pool of just, say, the Stark box plus the core set, three core sets, is that it's kind of like a mid-rangey, flexible deck that you can sort of do a variety of play styles. It can rush really hard with Eddard plus Rob plus Blackfish. It can play a bit more of the sort of, like, poke you, slowly win with, like, an Arya power challenge every turn kind of thing. It can say, you're not going to have any fun with Catelyn plus Winterfell, just again ignoring the more recent cards, just with these limited card pools, it gives you a lot of flexibility. And Stark playing mono Stark, it gives you kind of the thematic resonance that second edition is going for. You want to play those. I mean, Stark needs to play those big characters like Rob and Eddard, excuse me, and Blackfish, but it also, like, the plays, the more you play Stark, the more you realize the plays are very intuitive and you've got to really figure it out and spend some time thinking about, like, what is going to get you out of some tough spots. So I think Stark has a flexible game plan and also has a lot of thematic high points, but it has, again, the more effort you put in, the more reward. It's a multi-dimensional deck, even if it's seems like it's not.
Yeah, I have this might not be a popular suggestion, but I have a sort of a real world example of this very scenario. I've recently brought in a former Magic buddy of mine to Thrones, and he's only played the game, you know, a handful of times. And we went to a regional, and I gave him Night's Watch Fealty, and you know, sort of. He'd played it a handful of times. It's a fairly linear strategy. So the Night's Watch defense is definitely another deck I would say is a good starting point. I think if you have the core set plus a couple chapter packs, probably the Haunted Forest and the Dolorous Edd chapter pack, I think you can play a decent Night's Watch defense deck.
You know, I thought so too, but I gave a Night's Watch defense deck like that to a buddy of mine that came down from the first player championship who had played a ton of first edition and whatnot. So he even had a starting point understanding of the game. But I'm afraid that defense deck, as simple as the game plan sounds, if anything disrupts that game plan, I think it can be so much harder to recover from that or to change gears, sure. to try to go on the offensive or something.
Yeah. I suppose it can feel bad. My experience is anecdotal, right? My friend did really well with the Night's Watch defense deck. But yeah, I agree. Like, it does sort of spiral out of control, if things aren't going your way. But yeah, strategy is very linear. Like, there's no real arguing that as far as in condition. And I think that's one of the complaints I hear about the deck a lot is it's just like, oh, I'm just going to block all three challenges and I'm going to win. I'm going to gain power passively with the ball and I'm going to win the game. So, I mean, you know.
I've been playing a lot of – I think we're going to go way too much down a rabbit hole about Night's Watch. I think I agree way more with Will, though. I think obviously – I think – you can run Highland Night's Watch and see the wall on the first turn and all your icons and just be like, defend, kneel the wall, get two power, win dominance.
I'm on the side that the deck is more nuanced than that, especially when you get into like the builder's territory. But I do think that if you feel like you're a relatively competent card player, I don't think it's a terrible place to start. But you know, we can disagree on that. That's okay.
Yeah, I think we're gonna have to disagree because I think you gotta. Like, it's not about being a competent card player. It's about Knights. I think Knights Watch more than many other factions rewards time with it to sort of see yourself out of those difficult situations that Will was describing. That can really, really make you have people complain about Knights Watch being an NPE, but losing with Knights Watch is in many ways more of an NPE than beating people sometimes with Knights Watch. Like when you just like have all anyway. So I'm sure that will also be an unpopular opinion, but like when Knights Watch Knights Watch gone wrong is like just a miserable play experience, and for the person who's playing Knights Watch. So I think I would never give a Knights Watch defense deck to a new player, even with card game experience. I would maybe give like Lanny Reigns to somebody. Like with a Magic background in particular, I would
give
someone like Lanny Reigns because that's a deck that rewards like basic card game knowledge of like triggers and interactions and things. But
yeah, we can agree to disagree. That's fine. Yeah.
Now we're in the weeds.
Okay.
All I know is I want that regional's top 8 playmat back from my friend.
He owes you.
No, it's fine. Those are some pretty good basic deck ideas as far as like where to start from the core set.
Yeah. In that case, then, I think we keep talking about, you know, this limited pool that we're kind of hypothetically talking about. But we're mentioning other bits and bobs, you know, plots and things from other packs and boxes beyond the core set. So I thought it might be fun to run down a bit of a buying guide. I went ahead and
mocked up here my list in order of the top 10 purchases that I would make if I was working on kind of expanding my pool and whatnot. But I should specify that this is after you've already bought three core sets. Like, let's be honest, you're just always going to want three core sets as a starting point in this game. It comes with so many options to start with, and you need it, you know, for a full play set of everything in there. So,
Can I ask the question? Do you have sort of the highlight cards from these packs listed, or should I be ready to sort of? Because I don't remember every pack specifically by name.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, I figured I would mention my criteria for why I placed it there.
Okay.
Cool. So I was going to see if you guys want to respond and or deride me for these choices after each choice, or if you want me to run through all 10 and then deride me.
Why don't we just play it by ear, Will? We'll see what your choices are, and we'll see what happens.
Yep.
Okay. All right, here we go. So the first three here are in a chunk because for new players, you may or may not know that this game is going to feature a rotation system vaguely akin to Magic the Gathering and the like. What that means is the cards that you buy, right, will be legal for official competitive play.
Card releases are slow as molasses as well.
So the cards that you buy will be legal for official competitive play for a set duration, and then will drop out of that rotation, as it were, as new cards are released. But there is an exception to that, or several exceptions. The core set cards are never supposed to rotate, nor are any of the deluxe boxes. So yet another reason to start with three core sets. It's a safer investment, as it were. And so then my first three purchase choices are the currently available deluxe boxes for that reason.
Yep.
But I still think there's a specific order to tackle them in. And first up, I think your first purchase should be Lions of Casterly Rock. Now, on the one hand, I am a Lannister fanboy, so I think that's a great idea. But there are some characters that that folks are really going to enjoy the punch of, like Cersei Lannister, good filler like Tina. There's reasonable stuff for other houses available here, like Victarion Greyjoy and Barristan Selmy are great mid-range characters. But what really sold me on this being choice number one out of these boxes is the Ocean Road, which is just such a huge income location for any house that's using a banner of some variety. And I really feel like being able to expand your income options in second edition should be a priority.
Yeah, not to derail the idea of buying into the deluxe boxes first, I totally agree that Ocean Road is a very important early purchase. I think, potentially, and we'll get there, I think the econ, like the neutral, just neutrals in general, neutral econ, neutral events, and are going to be really high priority as far as your
early
purchases go. So, and don't forget about Reigns of Castamere, especially if we're sort of suggesting that as a potential early deck to play. I don't know, but
Time of Plenty in the plots so fantastic.
While I think the deluxe boxes in general have been, you know, maybe especially the faction that they're specific to, we haven't seen a really high power level of characters come out of those or cards come out of those deluxe boxes yet. Yeah, there's definitely probably the most good or in the Lanny box. I think I agree with you, Will.
I think I agree with Will, but kind of think that you need to view the Stark and the Lanny box together, and just basically if you're going to – the first step would be to buy the core sets and then buy the Lanny and the Stark box together. I think that that's sort of the best way to view it, because I think to get taken together those two boxes, I think they're mechanically very straightforward. There's nothing overly complicated minus a few cards, but say 75% of their cards are very straightforward. The themes are very obvious. There's the Klansman theme and the intrigue theme for the Lannister box. There's the sort of rush and kind of like no fun in the Stark box that kind of immediately says, okay. And they're the two factions everybody loves kind of going into the thematically, right?
Yeah, I can't argue with that, yeah.
So that's what I would say. The Night's Watch box, I definitely think we should place third, because I think the Night's Watch box on a understanding Game of Thrones, the card game, is a higher level box than the other two. I think by the nature of just sort of Night's Watch's themes, of like, you know, you guys got Abandoned Stronghold generally kind of wrong, right? Even though being experienced Thrones players, because you kind of need to think about what the card pool looks like, and there's a lot of cards that interact. Like, Kraven isn't in that box, but a lot of cards in the box interact with Kraven. And so they're not as isolated an experience with the Night's Watch box. So I think that would be the third purchase you would make.
And
yeah,
a sort of a counterpoint to this, if you wanted to be extremely economical about your purchases, I think you could honestly skip the boxes and just go straight for a couple of the packs with the high impact neutrals, which I think we'll be getting to next. Like Great Hall and Nightmares, but I'll leave that to the next sort of chunk of packs, and maybe they will appear in those. So,
yeah. Okay. Well, for what it's worth, just so I did blatantly say it for the listeners, my second choice then would have been the Wolves box, and definitely third the Night's Watch box out of the deluxes. But I think we've pretty well discussed kind of those options there. They have some reasonable in-house options for the various other houses. I just feel their neutral options are less strong than the Lannister one. So
yeah.
Okay, so that sends us into the actual chapter packs. Okay, so the first chapter pack then that I would say is worth a purchase may actually surprise you based on what I said about Econ. I actually think my first suggestion is going to be Calm Over Westeros, mainly on the back of Nightmares as an event in that particular pack, but also it's got phenomenal Targ and Greyjoy cards in it, in Miri Mazdur and Iron Mines. It has a very playable Lannister event in Trial by Combat. Pulling the Strings sees plays intermittently in Tyrell. I think those are really kind of the highlights of the pack right there. But yeah, I think it's a strong pack.
That's a really good pack. I can't disagree with that at all. I mean, if I had more time to sort of compare all the different chapter packs, maybe I'd have a stronger opinion. But I mean, those are all everything you said is a home run card that is going to be great in the arsenal of a new player. So,
yeah, I mean, it's hard to disagree. Those are great cards to own.
Okay.
And I do think that Nightmares is in that sort of ubiquitous tier.
Yeah, you want to buy two. Right.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah. We'll play lot of draft.
I was happy to assemble my draft set of Nightmares actually at Nationals this year. So I've got my second set of Nightmares. My one being the regular and one being draft. I love to play the draft cards in Joust because it kind of just they look like they're cheap knockoffs, you know, and you get an odd look from your opponent.
I love it too. I pull the draft cards when I'm building decks before I build the.
Yeah, me too. Cards. Me too.
Just make sure you sleep.
Yeah. So what's the next pack?
The next one I would suggest is Guarding the Realm. That is probably about 80% on the back of Great Hall being included. Here I go back to harping on Econ. This one has been such a huge boost and kind of an impact here in the meta in continuing to push these high-cost characters. You get one of those high-cost characters in the pack in Melisandre, though she's maybe not the very best exemplar. She's at least interesting and splashy, but you also get Marriage Pact.
for Stark. Lord Renly's ride has turned out to be surprisingly useful for House Tyrell. Even Wex Pike and Greyjoy is very effective. So
The Targ.
I think the other options are. Yeah, what's that?
The Targ recurring event, the Dragon Slave, is a decent addition. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the value of these cards, since this is a relatively recent pack, a lot of the ultimate value for some of these cards is unknown, but the impact of Great Hall is so high that it's, you know, I don't really have any qualms with it being after the Nightmares pack, but I would also have no issue if someone prioritized buying the Great Hall pack first, just because the card is so good.
Yeah, admittedly, that was the decision I had the most trouble with when I was putting this together, which of those two to list first in my pack selection.
Yeah, another one of those packs where you might just want two of if you're really, really into Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah,
okay. I
can't disagree.
Okay, well, after that, I actually think I... Now, this one may be a little bit of a surprise here. This time, I'm going to kick it over to the Road to Winterfell. And this one, again, is in large part on the back of Econ. And with those kind of opener plots we were talking about, this brings us trading with the Pentoshi. But it also gives access to Shadowblack Lane, which is a very handy neutral card advantage and card. For Martell, it brings us Nymeria Sand. For Targaryen, Crown of Gold. For Lannister, Wardens of the West. Heck, I got blown out at the first player championship by In the Name of your King for Baratheon. Go figure. Lady Sansa's Rose for Tyrell. I think this has a lot of very solid options as well.
Yeah, definitely. It was. I remember when that pack came out in the Corset meta, and it changed the game. So it's definitely will massively expand your collection and open up your options. So I can't recommend it more. Actually, I would probably actually bump it up more now that you're thinking about. Now that you've listed those cards, I may even put it.
Nice.
Because trading. In many ways, I think to a new player is even better of a card than Great Hall, because Great Hall makes you think about deck building in a way that maybe might be challenging to a new player. But trading basically says just play your shit.
Yeah, there are just some decks that don't function unless they have access to trading. So it's definitely another important card to get your hands on as soon as possible.
It's a lower
skill and Nymeria
actually. I'd say
Nymeria, one of my favorite cards. I'm a Martell fanboy at heart, and Nymeria is a fantastic card.
She's a big piece, I think, in making them actually competitive. I think they were definitely behind the times in just the Corset meta.
Yes, odd how they continually find themselves there.
Hmm. Yeah.
Well, I mean, but also this is the pack that unleashed the Targ Sun meta upon us, mm-hmm. and the Lanny Sun meta upon us. Let's not forget that.
Indeed, yeah. Nymeria, yeah. She was a
huge dominated the game.
Yeah, she did. All right, what do we have next?
Okay, next up... Oops, I didn't close that tab. There we go. Next up, I'm going to kick over to For Family and Honor. That one is going to bring us... let's see... going to bring us the Lannister Harrenhal, going to bring us the Ashai Priestess, it's going to bring us the good Renly Baratheon for Tyrell, it's going to, let's see, it's going to bring us Dissension, which is kind of an eh, but this pack, I think, I largely picked on the basis of kind of my part of my consideration there in Nymeria, bringing up a house that had been at the bottom of the keep in such a large boost. For me, Renly Baratheon was such a big piece of bringing Tyrell kind of up to par that I think new players are going to want him relatively quickly so that they can, you know, potentially really play a deck of any house.
Yeah, if you're a Tyrell loyalist, it's definitely a pack you're going to want. I think that there's a clear separation in the tier sort of between the previous three packs and this one. But yeah, I mean, and it seems like when the factions sort of gain relevance or gain momentum in the competitive setting, they usually end up going on a run of consecutive chapter packs where they are given really high power level cards. And this was right in the middle of that for Tyrell. It's a solid pack. I mean, I definitely would get the other three first. No questions asked.
And the next pack I've got maybe should have been ahead of this one. Now that I'm, thinking and we've been discussing more. So
yeah, let's
see what you guys think.
I don't necessarily think so, because I think Renly, I mean, you're forgetting Harrenhal, right? Also, which opens up amounts of, it sort of fuels that jumper archetype, which is kind of moved out of the competitive scene a little bit, but it's still a viable deck. And if you look at the cards in your Lannister box, if you went Lannister box into this chapter pack, you could build a Clansman jumper deck very, very easily. If you have the Stark deck to supplement it, with Tower of the Hand. I think Renly, though, just is such a key card for Tyrell. He should basically be a core set card. If you want Tyrell to be a competitive faction, like I remember when I was buying into first edition, there were some packs like the one that had Mirror Reed in it, that basically all the buying guides on CraigMDB and other places were like, look, just go and buy this pack. And because it makes a whole faction viable in the current card pool. And that, in many ways, is what this pack is for Tyrell. So if you're at all interested in Tyrell, even more than Pleasure Barge, even more than the Arbor, Renly gives you that bomb that lets you compete with Lannister and Stark and Baratheon.
Yep.
Pleasure Barge is so good. But yes, Renly is arguably...
Oh, I know. Believe me, Pleasure Barge was on the short list as I was trying to trim and figure this out.
Yeah. All right, so what do we have next? I'm curious to sort of juxtapose these two packs here.
Yeah, well, the next one is actually our most recent pack, the Fall of Astapor. That brings us two of the new income locations, Underground Vault and Dornish Fiefdom, and arguably the two factions that needed that the most.
Yeah.
But on top of that, you also get Grey Worm and Astapor, which are such huge cards to boost burn in Targaryen.
Yeah. Talk about getting a good run of cards. Targaryen, I don't know the last time they had a card printed that wasn't really solid.
Giscari Elite.
I don't even know.
Underwhelmed people.
Yeah, I don't know when that was, but I'm pretty sure it was at least like three packs ago, right?
I think it was the first pack of this cycle.
First pack, but this Fair also, enough. Did they get the econ location in the first pack too?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, so that overshadowed the Elite a little bit. But yeah, Astapor is a really solid pack. Like you said, Targ, its relevance for Targ, both of the Targ cards are amazing. The Martell location, I don't know if you guys have played with it at all, is really good.
And
I'm hoping it will bring the revival of some Martell decks. It's a really solid pack. I personally would probably get Fall of Astapor before I bought... I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the name of the previous pack, but the Renly pack.
I closed that tab, remember.
For Family and Honor?
For Family and Honor. I don't know. Yeah. Actually, here, I'll push back a little bit about this. I mean, Guarding the Realm is really good, but I think it's... Not Guarding the Realm, I'm sorry. Fall of Astapor. Well, because I was thinking about it. I think it's only good in the context of the third cycle.
Sure.
Like, you need... For the Targ cards in here to be good, you need... The econ location, and you need the event that they got in Guarding the Realm.
Sure.
So, but on its own, Harrenhal, particularly with the limited card pool, Harrenhal, Renly, there was a third card that you mentioned that I can't.
I guess I'm just operating under the assumption.
The Ishai Priestess.
Ishai Priestess, which is really good if you have a limited card pool because it makes your Bare Fealty deck way more consistent.
Right.
So
I guess I'm just operating under the assumption that if the players are sort of buying them in the order we're suggesting, you know, like they're going to have access to that econ and stuff. But I mean, yeah, it's close, right? They're both strong packs. I guess my preference, as you know, leaning towards certain play styles or strategies, I would go Astapor War first.
Yeah, I guess I don't know. I think the thing about Targ is Targ got so many bad cards for the first and second cycle.
Yeah.
The fact that they got three packs in a row that they got a soft dud, because Kaskari Elite's not that bad of a card.
No, it's not, but it just pales in comparison to the other
right, what? Yeah. Seven cards. Or no, five cards that they got. So the fact that above all in the third cycle, they've gotten amazing cards compared to the cards that they got in particularly the second cycle. Is sort of like it accelerates it, and I think if we look at a more meta level, I'd actually say that Will has actually placed these two packs in a good order.
Fair.
Because I think Targ is playable out of the core set without any of its nonsense. While absolutely. Tyrell, as someone who played mono Tyrell at the first Red Saturday for second edition, no. Yeah. But if Renly had been in that deck, just without any of the other cards that Tyrell got in the first cycle, just had Renly, the deck would have been a lot better.
Yeah, so. Just think how sad Tyrell players will be when Renly eventually rotates.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
But maybe we'll have a Tyrell box or a Evergreen Renly. You know, maybe we'll have like a five cost Renly in the Barra box or whatever's next. So,
all right. So what we have two packs left. Why don't you throw them out at the same time, and then we can kind of like duke it out and figure out which one we want out of the other.
Okay, sounds good. So the one I've got in spot nine is the King's Peace. This is going to bring us the Lord of the Crossing agenda, which I think is going to be one of the other prime agendas you want to grab as a new player that has proven to be competitive. It is a pretty straightforward game plan, very aggro there. But you also get a Tainted, which I think has proven to be kind of the favorite of the Martell icon removal attachments. You get Newly Made Lord, which is just solid utility. You get Gregor Clegane, which is still a beat stick. You get Sir Hobber Redwyn, which is the Lady Search knight in Tyrell, which I think can really make a lot of decks sing. So I think this is just kind of a lot of solid pieces aside from the Lord of the Crossing. And then the final pack, I almost forgot that I was laying them both out there. The final one I've got is There's My Claim. And here's the one that I figured might be the most controversial. I'm putting the pack that brought Valor Morghulis into the game as actually my lowest priority on this buy list. So it does have Valor Morghulis. It has Jack and Hagar, which I've really got a soft spot for. You know, some reasonable kind of filler stuff like Elia, Sand, and Pyat Pri. You know, filler Lannister. You know what? I'm not even going to say Tanda Stoke versus a good filler character for Lannister. But without his beard, has turned out to be very reasonable, especially if you have the Lannister box and you've got that Cersei, you've got things like the seven cost Stannis. You have, here you go, the Haunted Forest.
That card's amazing.
Yeah.
I personally came to Thrones because of cards like Valor in first edition. So for me, I would have to put this up there with the first three. I understand that not every new player, you know, wants to play a card like Valor or even should. But for me personally, it was a big reason why I got into the game. I think there are a subset of players who are going to want to buy Valor like really early. And there are others who won't and shouldn't, and that's fine. But that pack has other all-stars as well. Haunted Forest, pretty makes the Night's Watch deck, the Night's Watch defense deck, you know, as consistent as it is.
Shadow Tower Mason is also in that pack. So
is it? Oh, and that's another one.
Yeah.
And that was in that Night's Watch run where they were just getting good card after good card after good card. So yeah, I would put the 10th before, but I understand why you put it last. It's kind of one of those things where you don't want someone to have Valor too early, but they, if they're going to play competitively, they're going to need to learn to play with it eventually, and it's definitely going to be a card they're going to need at some point. I have players, I know players in my meta, really, really skilled players, I won't mention any names, but who have such an aversion to Valor that they won't play it. They just don't like that kind of effect, and you know, I can respect that. So it's not for everyone. You can still be a really good player and not ever use Valor in any of your decks. So
yeah, I think you're right though to place this kind of last, because I do think it is a must buy because of the two Night's Watch cards, because of Valor, because in many ways of the two Martell cards, Elias Sand and Burning on the Sand, are also in here. But there's a lot of duds, like big duds in here, like the Wolf King, which has proven to be
Vase Talaro,
which is a terrible card.
I don't even know what that card does.
only
Red God's Blessing.
Only Vase Talaro is only not the worst target card because he's not Vase Dothrak. Which is like, you know, they have a
FFG just hates Vase locations.
It's bigotry against the Dothraki. That's all I gotta say. You know, like King Baron Solar, which has proven to kind of be a bit of a dud as well. There's like a lot of duds in this pack, but its successes are so above the curve, both in Valor. But I mean, you of course can just come to a New York City tournament and you can get a Valor without buying the pack. But but Shadow Tower Mason and Haunted Forest are sort of like, if you're going to build a Night's Watch defense deck, well, that's not true because the Stark Watch deck doesn't run the Shadow Tower Mason, but it does run Haunted Forest. You need those cards in many ways. You know, and there's some good utility cards, but I think it's a weak pack besides the sort of standout one. So I think it deserves its 10th place finish. Because you want to own it, you want to have it in your collection, even if your collection's small, but it's not something that you can build interesting, compelling decks without any of these cards, besides Night's Watch defense.
I just love me some Valor.
I mean, I love Valor in theory, too. I like watching games where other people play Valor against other people. When I'm playing, I'm not always entirely sure if Valor is a card I want to see. But, like, at an objective level, you know, game design level, a meta level, I like Valor. But I don't necessarily like it in my own games.
All right. Well, I think that you rated those pretty well, Will.
Yeah, you did a good job. Really, at the end of the day, new player, ignore the ratings of each one, and these are actually 10 good packs to purchase. So to spend your first $100 after the core set, this is where you would want to spend it.
Yeah, and I'm sure that people will deride us on Facebook about a pack that we forgot that has an obvious card that we should have included. So
the Hound from that first pack.
Yeah, the Hound is really
good.
But we could go into a very deep rabbit hole about cards we neglected, I'm sure. So,
well, there you have it. I guess that is new player episode take two, second edition, you might say.
Sweet.
Yeah. Props and slops?
Let's do it.
All right. Anybody have any this week?
I have props, and I can probably figure out slops while I'm propping.
Okay.
So I guess I'll start. Props to Alejandro Pantoja and Brad Norman for coming up with this really cool ELO system based on the Jousting Pavilion results. I believe it's isleofravens.com. Is that right? Yeah, isleofravens.com.
I think so.
It's super cool, and though it has its flaws, mostly based on, you know, what tournaments are entered into the Jousting Pavilion, one of the major flaws being that like a large percentage of the Tome events that are run through Tome, so the FFG official events aren't on Jousting Pavilion, means that some of the bigger tournaments in America are missing. And so I think it's disproportionately slanted towards the European players, and also the flaws within the ELO system and card games. I think it's really cool that they did it, and it got a lot of people talking about competitive Thrones in a way that I hadn't seen. And so good job to Alejandro and Brad for doing that. I hope you guys keep it up and keep making changes and keep, you know, making improvements. And I really can't support that effort anymore.
I think it's great.
Slops. Surely I have some slops. Slops to me for not sending my alt art house cards to Dan in New York in time for this weekend. I really, really, really meant to do that, and I just work got in the way. I'm going to be sending those out to Dan. He was very kind and sent us some alt arts for nationals that we used in the team tournament, and it went over really well. So I guess a second props to him, but also slaps to me for not getting those in the mail in time. So I will still be sending them this week, but they will not be there in time to be prize supported dance, unfortunately. So,
well, that's fine. We run other events, but I mean, the reason they were so, our alt arts were so popular out west is we have the best alt arts in North America. So,
them's fighting words, but they are really good. I do really like them.
I tell Thompson, and I tell Ryan, and I tell anybody, like, we just have the best. Some of that props go to Sean Emberley for doing a lot of the graphic design work. Props go to the art team that we have. Good thing you brought up dance. I guess by the time this episode airs, this is airing in 2 weeks, Will?
Yeah, a week and a half from when you're recording.
I prop everybody who came to Dance with Dragons 2. I'm sure it's a massively successful event. Right now, as of this current episode that we're recording with pre-registrations, what looks like we'll have the largest regional in North America so far, coming close to nationals numbers, which is a huge accomplishment. I really appreciate everyone coming out. I want to prop my girlfriend who's been playing The Witcher 3 for like the last week, which has been a kind of fun and awesome experience to watch her go through it. I want to prop Summer Vacation, which I will be on. Comes on. I'll be on my week break before I have to go back for a week of prep, and then we start our summer session. But I'm sure I'll be really enjoying that by the time the next episode we record. Aaron should be on break by then too. So I don't know if I have any. Oh, slops to humidity. Humidity is the worst.
Oh my god, yes.
Well, you live on the West Coast, like that.
Yeah, okay, but I'm from the Midwest. Something I didn't realize when I moved to the West Coast is houses don't have central air. So it'll be 85, 90 degrees, and there's no air conditioning in the house. So
why?
I know. I finally caved, and I bought a portable air conditioning unit after 4 years of living out west, and it's been glorious. But yeah, humidity, it's terrible. I agree with you.
Yeah. You know what humidity does? Will? Wait, Will. What do you have to say?
You know, it's tough here. I'm just gonna slop the world. I try in general not to be political on this show, so I'll just leave it up to listeners if they're curious to look up what was going on the 14th of June. But what a mess, man.
It was a messy day. Yeah, thank God for Thrones, because I desperately need the distraction at times. So,
yeah, I hear you there.
Yeah.
On the more positive side, I'll prop cats.
Cats are a perennial plot Well, particularly mine. She's being very adorable right now.
Are we in like a cats greater than dogs situation here, or we're not going to go down that path?
I mean, dogs are great.
I think
cats are better. That's all.
Yeah.
All right. I can neither confirm nor deny my opinion on this.
Basically, you're outnumbered.
Yeah. I love cats, but I grew up with dogs.
But Will, to go back a step though, would you say that humidity, particularly humidity without air conditioning, puts us in the danger zone?
Yes.
Yeah, the danger zone for being in a really shitty mood.
That's the most dangerous of zones.
Indeed.
And you know, it's really hard definitely to close chapters of books, right? When the humidity sticks to your hand.
Yeah, they stick. It's terrible.
You can't like terrible the pages and I don't know. So.